Very much, Pastor. It's a blessing to be here. Thank you, Brandt family. That was delightful. Mom and Dad, you must be awfully proud of those daughters of yours, highly talented. What a blessing it was to hear that, and we're all looking forward to flying away someday. And looking out and looking at everybody, it's a joy to see so many familiar faces back in the land that my wife and I know and love so well, which is up in this area of the country. It's a joy to be here. I was almost going to say it's a joy to get out of Texas, but why start off negative about Texas? I mean, we've got days to build on it, so it's not necessarily a joy to get out. It's just a joy to get back into this area. A little breezy today, and like it is sometimes, but really, really nice to see everybody here. Well, you probably know I had to move. I was the national representative. I got to work for well over a decade remotely from the Black Hills, while everybody else was, I almost said banished. Everybody else lived in Texas. I mean, I don't know. And we got to work remotely, and then I got appointed this job as president, and it's hard to do that remote. So we moved down there, and fortunately, we rented an apartment, and it's right across the street from the ministry. So basically, I just walk across the street to work. I'm not in any traffic for 40 minutes on a good day, an hour and 40 minutes on a bad, or any of those other kinds of things. It's a blessing. We are going to be doing the first ever scientific expedition of ICR this year, this summer. And guess where we're going to head?
Black Hills.
That's right, the Black Hills, of course. There's a lot of good scientific things up there. We have a lot of things we want to accomplish. We need to get some artifacts and things for our Discovery Center. We're going to take footage to make two DVDs that we're going to release. One will be on the research that Dr. Tim Clary has been doing on worldwide flood, the layers and things that he's been documenting that have been laid down. The next is the topic that I'm going to talk about tomorrow night, which is continuous environmental tracking, a engineering-based, organism-focused way to explain how organisms adapt. We're going to get lots and lots of still photos that we don't currently have to put in our magazine. We're currently using a lot of stock photos. We're going to get rid of the stock photos and start featuring some of our own scientists. And then, you may not know this, the pastor knew this, I actually own a piece of property just a few miles south of Devil's Tower, not too far from here. And 2 years ago, we had an event in the Black Hills, a science event. And for a couple days before we did the event, we did some tours. And one of the tours we did was a day we went out to the coal mines here in Gillette. And a lot of people walk on coal that's 100 foot thick that can only really be explained by a worldwide flood. And then on our way back, we did a tour of Devil's Tower. And that's about the highway that goes there. It's only about a mile from my property. So I had the geologist with me and another person with me in my car, and I said, I need to stop by, take a look at my building. It's been winterized, and I want to make sure everything's good with it. And besides, there's a great view of Devil's Tower I'd like you to see. So I got the geologist out there, and I said, look at this great view. And he said, hey, Randy, you got the Morrison Formation on your property. It's like, well, who cares? You know, a formation's mation. Look at this great view of Devil's Tower. He says, yeah, but you got the Morrison. I said, so? He said, well, sometimes there's dinosaur bones in it. Anyway, while I'm looking at the view, he dropped down, and about 2 or 3 minutes later said, hey, Randy, found the dinosaur bone. And he did. I walked down there. I thought, oh, it's probably a cow bone. He's all confused. But it wasn't. It was a real dinosaur bone. And the next week, my wife and I beat feet back out from Rapid City, and we found bones. I kid you not, I found some bones that are this big around in the ground. So one of the things we're going to do on this science expedition is we're going to excavate these bones. In the past, we've had to purchase the bones. And sometimes people in schools that are oriented towards evolution won't even let you do any research on the bones, no matter what you'll pay them, because they don't want to have creationists do research. Well, the Lord provided bones. lots of bones, and we'll get some videos of people excavating the bones and all those kinds of things. That's going to happen right at the end of August through mid-September. So we're looking forward to that, and it ought to be a really good time. And then from the Black Hills to the Devil's Tower, then we're going to go over towards the Bighorns, do some filming in the Bighorns, then over to Yellowstone, filming over there, down towards the Tetons. And then how many of you know where Kemmerer, Wyoming is? Kemmerer, it's over there. There's the Green River Formation. Okay, the Green River Formation is where you see all over in books and other places all those flattened fish that are buried alive very, very quickly, a fish eating another fish and those kinds of things. A lot of those fossils, probably 80%, come from the Green River Formation out in Wyoming. And so we'll hit the Green River Formation. And how many of you know, see, I can hardly, this, there are very many places I can go that I can actually do this. How many of you know where a place called Como Bluffs is? Como Bluffs, it's north of Laramie. Ah, okay, it's north of Laramie. Como Bluff is actually a world-famous dinosaur dig from the late 1890s. Some of the best specimens in the world have been taken from Como Bluff, just north of Laramie, Wyoming. And in a newsletter that I sent out, a rancher who owns just a mere 14,000 acres north of Como Bluff, he said there he's leasing his property to a couple paleontologists, and they just uncovered a complete Allosaurus. It's like those big brontosaurus dinosaurs on his property. He said, come on out. You can film. You can do what you want. And next year, if you need to dig some dinosaur bones, come out there as well. So really, really nice, and any chance we can get, we try to get back to this area of the country. Well, that catches you up on what I'm doing right now. Let's talk about some major evolutionary blunders, and the things I'm going to talk about are actually in this book, 20 Evolutionary Blunders. I can't go through all 20 of them tonight by any means, but we'll go through some major ones. We'll go through some key blunders that all of you should know, and as it mentioned on the cover slide there, not just major evolutionary blunders, why they happen. That's really more important than the blunders themselves and how they're damaging to science. So this book right here documents everything I'm going to talk about. It has all the footnotes and everything like that in it. So if you're interested in it and you don't want to take notes, like I usually don't, my wife, though, you know, she would take notes like crazy just for the joy of taking notes. That's the difference between her and me. Mine, it's the joy of not taking notes. And so if you don't like to take notes, everything I'm going to mention is in this book right here. So we're going to have basically, as it says up there on the screen, a friendly conversation with some of your favorite evolutionists. Now you're looking up there on the screen, and some of you recognize Richard Dawkins and Jerry Coyne and others right there, even Charles Darwin, of course, in the middle of it. But what the middle of the slide says is important. What are they seeing when they're claiming so much evidence for evolution? And what are they saying about what they're seeing? That's what we're talking about. What do they see? Are they seeing the same things that you're seeing, and why aren't they seeing them? Now, several years ago, I actually did a talk on the visual system, and I know you remember it like the back of your hand on that. It was only about 6 years ago. And I mentioned to you that when you actually see something, there's a process going on in your brain where data, and that's all it is, your eyes are just data collectors. You're not seeing with your eyes. Even though you're looking at me right now and you think you're seeing me with your eyes, you're not. You're seeing me with your brain. And it's actually way at the back where your neck connects to your skull. This is the part of the brain where you're actually seeing me right now. And it's using all of your brain because you're collecting all the data. And in your memories, somewhere, there's memories of a man. And when you see me, it's matching those patterns incredibly rapidly, far, far faster than the fastest supercomputers on this planet, matching tons of data. In fact, you're matching more data, and your eyes are taking in more data, just by way of a trivial fact, than all of the data that's being transferred on telephone lines. I don't care whether hard lines, cell phone lines, and for any of the businesses and all of the people for all of the state of Wyoming, Montana, South Dakota, North Dakota, Minnesota put together. Right now. That's what your eyes are doing. That's how much data they're processing. So you can imagine how much data is traveling on those telephone lines. Your eyes are doing far more than that. And they match patterns incredibly quickly. And as it does that, in your brain, you get the perception of seeing something. And it's all happening in your brain right there. So seeing happens, as it says there on the screen, when you match the data patterns of what's coming in with what you stored in your brain there. And the brain makes sense of that in all of those areas. And the sensation of seeing is what you realize. The problem is that many times they're not true patterns. You can get a lot of true patterns, but all of us can get faulty patterns or phony patterns or even phantom patterns for people who have hallucinations and those kinds of things. So what you're seeing, what you think you're seeing, may match up with reality, but it may not match up with reality. So very quickly, how many of you guys can see very fast the spooky house? Can you find the spooky house there? How many of you can see the primitive features on these fish? Can you see the primitive features? There, you're looking. Which ones are the primitive features? How many of you can see the ancient rock layers? Ah, now you realize you've been caught here in a trap, because the layers on the right-hand side of the screen were laid down in a period of 3 days with an eyewitness putting them down. 1980, the bottom two layers, and 1982, the top layer. And all those ones in the middle were placed in 4 hours. Wow. All of these layers, 4 hours, right there. So they're not ancient. The ones on the left-hand side of the screen, if you drive a couple hundred miles that way, they're in the Badlands of South Dakota. But they look an awful lot like the ones that were placed in just a matter of days. So you're not really looking at, I'm going to pull this so I can turn if I need to. You're not really looking at any ancient layers at all. In fact, you're not looking at any primitive features, because these fish are not primitive. You know how I know they're not primitive? Because they're still alive. Right now. There's not fossils. Someone caught those fish on that. They didn't catch them out of keyhole, but they caught them someplace else right along there. So when someone looks at those and they're seeing primitive features, it's because their brain has been programmed to see ugly old fish that look like they're fossils as displaying primitive features when they're not primitive at all. And you know what? Not any of those houses are any spookier than any of the other houses. It's just that your brain has been conditioned when you see some old, ugly, beat-up house that's a haunted house or that's the spooky house. Well, you know what? Your house may be as spooky as anyone else's house, for that matter. You know, how do you know what it is on there? And they probably say, have you seen my house? So primitive features, ancient layers, all those things, those are what you are actually perceiving. And so imagination, when I ask you about the spooky house, there's some imagination involved with that. Imagination can be a good thing. That gal there, she's imagining. Who knows what she's imagining? Maybe something that's going to help put a person on Mars or whatever. Imagination can help you realize things or perceive things that are not really there, but they don't necessarily have to be connected to any real experiences or any real information. And imagination can be a good thing if you're a child, but when you're doing science, imagination isn't necessarily your best friend. I'm an engineer. How much would you like me to design something based on imagination? Medical doctor, make your diagnoses, or better yet, prescribe your treatment plans based on imagination. In fact, sometimes they come out of the CDC. Oh, well, anyway, imagination can reign everywhere. But imagination is a key element of evolutionary theory. The man you see on the left-hand side of the screen, he's passed away. He was probably the leading evolutionary theorist ever. And in that regard, he was really, really good, Stephen Jay Gould. He mentioned in his book the framework or the structure of evolutionary theory. There were three main pillars, and one of them was this, extrapolationism, which is just another word for imagination. He said researchers use, quote, history from data of an imperfect record that cannot in any case see past causes directly, but can only draw conclusions from preserved results of these causes by explaining, quote, large-scale results by extrapolation from short-term processes. So he says we look at the present and we try to extrapolate into the past. And you know what that's called? Imagination. And when he's extrapolating a million years, 10 million years, 100, 200, 500 million years in the past, based on what he sees in the present, you need to invoke an awful lot of imagination. In fact, it's no longer even extrapolation by that period of time. It's just nothing but raw, unadulterated imagination. Richard Dawkins, probably the world's leading evolutionist right now, says, it took a very large leap of what? The imagination for Darwin and Wallace to see that contrary to all intuition. In other words, contrary to common sense. There is another way, and once you have understood it, a far more plausible way for complex design to arise out of primeval simplicity. A leap of the imagination so large that to this day, many people seem unwilling to make it. Maybe I'm one of the unwilling, and maybe you are too. He said that. Oh, Jerry Coyne, another leading evolutionist, he said, criticizing people like me. It's not valid, however, to assume that because one man, maybe me, cannot imagine such pathways, such evolutionary pathways, they could not have existed. Well, that's really good science. I say something like, wow, I can't imagine how this could possibly happen. Well, it must have been real, you know, just because you can't imagine it doesn't mean they couldn't have existed. Kenneth Miller, another leading evolutionist, said that, maybe speaking of me, anyone can state at any time that he or she cannot, and I'm not, that he or she part is not speaking of me, that he or she cannot imagine how evolutionary mechanisms might have produced a certain species, organ, or structure. Such statements obviously are personal, and they say more about the limitations of those who make them than they do about the limitations of the Darwinian mechanisms. Wow. Four major evolutionists all confirm that much of their theory is based on what? Imagination. And if you can't imagine it, it's not because they're wrong, it's there's something wrong with you, is what they're saying. Wow, nobody ever discusses this, but we're going to point out where imagination can get you in a lot of blunders. Now, many of you have already heard of Piltdown Man. You know it was a hoax. This is not to kick the evolutionists in the shins about the facts that they got duped by this hoax. It's to explain why and how they got duped by this hoax. We go all the way back to 1913, and this is a picture from the very first scientific journal, which was the leading journal in the world at that time, Science, maybe people from Great Britain would say Nature was, but it's one of the two top leading scientific journals, and they're reporting on the find of Piltdown Man in 1913. This is long before anybody thought it was a hoax, and this is what they say. This discovery of the bones for Piltdown Man was a discovery of the greatest importance, the nearest approach we have yet received to a missing link. Probably few will deny that Eanthropus Dawsoni, a man named Dawson, found him, that's why it's named after him, is almost, if not quite, as much human as simian. Wow, they found a missing link, something that looked partly human and something that looked partly like an ape. And this is what they found. Right here. You can see it. This is part of the skull, and here's part of a jawbone. Wow. And they're old. Look how discolored they are. Some of you might have a skull that looking that color, but most of us don't. Well, actually what they found was nothing. It was a forgery. The skull was that of a human, and the jawbone was that of an orangutan. And somebody, nobody knows who to this very day, discolored them. And they filed the teeth on the jaw to make them look old. But at the time, based on those bones, this was the picture in 1913. Do you see a little bit of imagination between that picture and those bones? Bones, picture. And you know what? When people, the average layperson, when they see a drawing like this on the screen, that's very persuasive to them. When you have kids the age of your kids and they're being taught this in school and teachers with authority are telling them this, this is pretty persuasive of them. But as I mentioned there, it turned out to be a hoax. In 1954, science retracted the whole paper and everything that reported on at the beginning, because it was nothing but an entire hoax. Even though this is a picture from 1915 of major scholars studying the skull and studying the jawbone, and some of these men were actually knighted. As it goes on to say, the skull eventually brought knighthood to three of its leading expositors. These learned gentlemen were honored after having spent many years and many pages discoursing on the very human features they discerned in Piltdown Man's ape-like jaw and the very ape-like features they found in his human cranium. The Piltdown skull illustrates the ever-present danger of scientists seeing exactly what they expect to see. So these men who were studying that human skull, when they studied it, they actually saw ape-like features in it. But where were they seeing them? In the skull or in their mind? In their mind. And when they were looking at that orangutan jawbone, they saw really human-like features in it. And they reported on it. And they wrote papers about it. But they're only seeing it in their mind. They're not actually seeing it in the features themselves. Well, nobody would do that today, would they? That's way over 100 years ago. Well, here's another one, Ida Darwinius. How many of you remember Ida? It wasn't that actually long ago when Ida burst onto the scene. It was back in 2009. Guardian reported this, fossil Ida is an extraordinary finding, the missing link in our human condition, which offers unprecedented insight into our ancestry. Wow, look at that fossil, it's nearly complete. And it's giving you unprecedented insight into your ancestry as you look at that. This paper went on to say, David Attenborough, the man who narrates all those shows that you see on nature and all the marvelous things that they film around the world, the more you look at Ida, the more you can see, as it were, the primate in embryo. So he's looking at those fossils and he's seeing your evolutionary ancestor. But my question to you is he seeing him in the fossils? Or is he seeing him in his mind? He's seeing in his mind. He's seeing something there that is telling him that. The man that discovered this fossil, Joram, said, this will be the one pictured in the textbooks for the next 100 years. Next 100 years, I ask you, how many of you remembered it? Nobody remembered it. Because it didn't even really make it 100 days. Because that was back in May of 2009. This paper, October 22nd, 2009. Controversial Ida is no missing link. It goes on to say that Ida wasn't even a close relative. Not even a close relative at all. And they went to say that Ida was as far removed from the monkey, ape, human ancestry as a primate could be. Completely wrong, because they imagined it. When we looked at the bones, we said, that looks an awful lot like a fossil lemur. And guess what it turned out to be? A fossil lemur. But somebody was looking at that, and they saw something in the monkey, ape, human ancestry on all of those things. Well, nobody would do that today, would they? Look at bones and see something, you know, through imagination. Nobody would repeat the same Piltdown Man blunder, would they? Well, of course they would, because evolution is based on imagination. So the Wall Street Journal report on this, the scientists find the oldest known specimen of the human species. And this is what this evolutionist said. It has a modern face in a primitive brain case. Wow, doesn't that harken back to Piltdown Man? Said John Flegel, an expert on primate evolution at Stony Brook School of Medicine, quote, you would expect it to have a few primitive characteristics, even if it's on the main line to our lineage. Primitive characteristics. How does he know what primitive characteristics would be? Where is he seeing primitive features? He's seeing them in his mind. So imagination can be good, but when it's imported into science, it can lead to one blunder after another. Jane Manshine, she's a professor at Arizona State University, she points out, quote, we only have to recall the Piltdown adventure to see how easily susceptible researchers can be manipulated into believing they have actually found just what they have been looking for. That's why these blunders happen. It's not because these people are dumb or they're uneducated or anything like that. It's because they believe in their heart so much in this monkey, ape, human ancestry that when they pick up bones which are genuinely human, they see ape-like features in them. Or they see primitive features. And I guarantee you they actually see them. It's not like they don't see it. They look at it and they think they see it. Just like anybody else would think they see it. Wow, that wouldn't happen in any other case. Well, this young man, he thinks he sees that pirate ship. And he really does. In his mind, he does. And that's where imagination can be useful. So, the thing about the Piltdown hoax is that it's not an anomaly. It's not an anomaly at all. In fact, it's the prototype for all of these imagination-based blunders. And we're going to go through several of those imagination-based blunders. Here's the next one, the imaginary Archaeoraptor. Now look at that. That's an interesting creature, an Archaeoraptor. Archaeo meaning primitive raptor, primitive bird. And this is a creature that was supposedly the transitional feature between birds and dinosaurs. It was featured in National Geographic. Feathers, dinosaurs take wing. Feathers for T-Rex. New bird-like fossils are missing links in dinosaur evolution. Wow. And that's what it looks like there up on the right-hand side of the screen. There's the fossil of it. You see there's this bird. You see it has like reptilian-like features. And from that, those bones right there, an artist gave the rendition of what Archaeoraptor probably looked like. And National Geographic said, this mix of advanced and primitive features is exactly what scientists would expect to find in dinosaurs experimenting with flight. There you go. The dinosaurs are just out there what? Conducting a few experiments with flight. Now, what do they expect? How do they know what advanced features are? How do they know what primitive features are? When they look at those bones, I can guarantee you the reason why they can see some as advanced and see some as primitive is because that's what they want to see. And that's what they see when they look at those kinds of things. Wow. National Geographic went on to say, this creature is a true missing link in the complex chain that connects dinosaurs to birds. It seems to capture the paleontological moment when dinosaurs were becoming birds. Wow. Captures it. Boom. And they see that transition. National Geographic is reporting this. This isn't the National Enquirer. Or maybe. They said this. We can now say that birds are pteropods. That's a dinosaur. Just as confidently as we can say that humans are mammals. That's a pretty definitive pronouncement. Everything from lunch boxes to museum exhibits will change to reflect this revelation. Wow, there was a lot of sad kids who were going to have to give up their favorite lunchbox because suddenly everything was going to change. Because they can see the primitive and they can see the advanced features and they can see the dinosaurs experimenting with flight. They can see all those things. Wow, can you see the dinosaur to bird transitional features here? The reason why I bring this up, because I was in a debate with a major evolutionist, and he said with a straight face to the audience when I was pressing him for transitional fossils, where are the transitions, he said, ladies and gentlemen, let me just tell you this, all you have to do to see the transitions is go to the zoo. And when you go to the zoo, you'll see these transitional features. I wanted to point out, these creatures have been reproducing after their kind in the zoo and out of the zoo since we've known them. How can they be transitional? He said, ostriches, that naked neck and those naked legs there, those are transitional features from dinosaurs to birds. And he insisted on it. Wow, looks like an ostrich to me. But in his mind, he's seeing transitional features. Well, Archaeoraptor turned out to be a hoax. It was two fossils, one of a reptile and one of a bird, that a Chinese person carefully, skillfully glued together. Anyway, this person reports on what happened. Red-faced and downhearted, paleontologists are growing convinced that they have been snookered by a bit of fossil fakery from China. The feathered dinosaur specimen that they recently unveiled to much fanfare apparently combines the tail of a dinosaur and the body of a bird, they say. Quote, it's the craziest thing I've ever been involved with in my career. Wow. Snookered. Taken in. Well, you know what? We can take you in if we're promoting something that you really think is going to be there, and you're going to believe with all your heart that you're going to find these kinds of things. So, imagination blunder number two. That's why it's all based on these things. The good news is, moms, you don't have to change the lunch boxes. You can keep on going with what it is, because the dinosaur experts were snookered again. So, Archaeoraptor, what you need to know. The bird-dinosaur link doesn't exist. It's not even real. It was just a forgery. It was a forgery which people paid good money for. National Geographic invested a lot of money to research it and publish it, but it was all a fake. Dino-to-bird beliefs are just another form of imagination where people see what they're going to see. But in terms of finding a true one, they're not out there. What about this piece of strong evolutionary evidence? Your appendix, that vestigial organ that's been left over for a long, long period of time. Do you realize it is still being taught today, maybe even at the University of Wyoming, as evidence for evolution? The fact that human beings have this thing in your body that shows that you evolved from some other creature? In fact, I know they're still being taught. Francis Aiello, who used to be the president of the American Academy of Sciences, the Advancement of Sciences, said this in Darwin's Gift. He says, a familiar rudimentary organ is the vermiform, that vermiform means worm-like, appendix. The human vermiform appendix, he says, is a functionless vestige of a fully developed organ present in other mammals. Vestiges are instances of imperfections, like the imperfections seen in anatomical structures. They argue, one, against creation by design, but two, are fully understandable as a result of evolution by natural selection. So he said the fact that you have this thing in your body is evidence against design. No good designer would design such a thing, but they make sense within an evolutionary context. Jerry Coyne, he said this in a 2005 article, the human body is also a plimpsest of our ancestry. Our appendix is the vestigial remnant of an intestinal pouch used to ferment the hard-to-digest plant diets of our ancestors. He goes on to say, an appendix is simply a bad thing to have. It is certainly not the product of intelligent design. How many humans died of appendicitis before surgery was invented? 2005, 2007. I went to medical school in the 90s and people were still teaching that as well. Well, when evolutionists claim that a portion of your body, an organ or whatever it is, has no function, you know what? That's an easy target to refute. The burden of proof isn't on you to show that it has a function. The burden of proof is really on them to show that it has no function. Now, how do you do that? How do you prove that something actually has no function? You know what the reality is? Everything on your body has a function. And not only that, I will assert this. Everything on your body has at least two functions. Is multifunctional. Not just has a function. I'm going to go point out that it has at least two functions. At least two. And for some of them, we could describe everything. So as I'm looking at you right now, you have hair, skin, teeth, all these other features, eyes, on and on and on. As I mention all of those things, you can easily think of, man, this has multiple functions. Not only are they there, but they actually serve multiple things. So when someone claims that has no function, the burden of proof is on them. Now look at these papers that are coming out. 2007, biofilm in the larger bowel says that there's a apparent function to the appendix. Scientists discover true function of the appendix organ. The appendix is useful. In fact, it is promising. This article went on to say, the body's appendix has long been thought of as nothing more than a worthless evolutionary artifact. Good for nothing, save potentially a lethal case of inflammation. Oh, pretty useful. Appendix evolved more than 30 times. Immunology studies suggest the appendix has a use after all. Appendix may have important function, new research suggests. 2017, although it was widely viewed as a vestigial organ with little known function, recent research suggests that the appendix may serve an important purpose. Do you want to know what it really does? It actually has not just one purpose, it has multiple purposes. And it actually sits in your body at a very important place. Inside the appendix is tissue that is part of your immune system. And cells in that actually sample what is going by as you're digesting it. And your body will adjust the types and amounts of bacteria in the gut to match the food that you're eating. Now, how does it get that information? The tissue in the appendix is sampling things as it goes from the small intestine to the large intestine. And it's strategically situated. Just like your tonsils, which people also thought were vestigial, are also strategically situated in two major places where you take something into your body, through your nose and in your mouth. And not only that, if you were to get a large, large dose of an antibiotic, or you were to get some other disease and wipe out the bacteria that is in your gut, the appendix stores a sample of all of that and it releases it so that it can multiply and reseed your gut. If you didn't have that, you'd have to have a fecal transplant. Nobody wants one of those. You know what a fecal transplant is? It's somebody donates some of their doo-doo, it's freeze-dried, and you take it as a pill to reseed your gut. You should be thankful you have an appendix on all of that. Wow. So, as in this case, it's better to be a giver than a receiver. Anyway, that's so on there. Oh, look at this came out, 2019. All our organs are vital. Even the appendix and tonsils are less expendable than we thought, Scientific American says. They report this. Many of us learned in school that this tiny finger-like projection off the colon is a useless vestigial remnant of our evolution, much like the puny leg bones found in some snakes. But that idea has been debunked. Wow, I don't know why that hasn't made its way into textbooks if it's been debunked. Data on 533 species of mammals and found that the appendix appears across multiple unrelated species. Oh, here's an article that came out. When was this? March 27th, 2021. That wasn't that long ago. What if humans didn't have an appendix? This is what they report. Charles Darwin suggested that the appendix was a vestigial organ from our ancestors that ate leaves, potentially helping them digest food. Darwin speculated that the appendix no longer served a function. Stop right there. That's a little bit of misrepresentation. Yes, Darwin speculated it, but I showed you that Francis Ayala did. Jerry Coyne did. I showed you that evolutionists living today did it. You just can't blame it on old Chuck back in the 1800s there. Other people did it today as well. They should say Darwin and other of the world's best evolutionists living today. That's what would be truthful. Darwin and probably professors at the University of Wyoming. That would be truthful. Speculated that the appendix no longer served a function, much like the small triangular coccyx bone at the base of your spine. Oh, so he's going to hold the coccyx as a vestigial structure, a remnant of tailbone found in our distant ancestors. So they're willing to repeat that little bit of propaganda right there. It says this, however, if Darwin knew what scientists know about the appendix, he would never have suggested it was a worthless vestige of our evolution, William Parker said at Duke University School of Medicine. He goes on to say in this, all in all, a world without an appendix might leave humanity struggling with germs more often. The idea that the appendix is an organ whose time has passed may have itself become a notion whose time is over. Well, let's rip that piece of evidence for evolution out of the textbooks because it's been debunked. Totally wrong and based on nothing but imagination. Imagination about it. But of course, we know the coccyx is a piece of good evidence. Okay, here's a chance to get to play doctor right here. Here's an abdominal x-ray of an 8-year-old Australian boy. You notice anything standing out to you? Well, everybody recognizes this, but obviously there's something right there that is blocking all the x-rays from getting through. What do you think that could be? Well, this Australian boy lives in a place far more rural than even Gillette, and the family eats food that his dad hunts, and he blasts the rabbits with a shotgun. Unfortunately, Dad is not that good at getting the pellets out of the rabbits, and as the boy is eating them, he's ingesting shot, and it's filling his appendix from end to end on that with shot. Now, that's something you don't see every day on that, so that's pretty cool. So, what you need to know about the appendix? It's not the same as a cecum. Its loss of function was given as evidence for evolution, but as we saw, that's just been debunked. And it serves very useful purposes in your body. The imagination that it was vestigial was totally, absolutely wrong. But when I was a student at Cheyenne Central High School, I was being taught this was evidence for evolution right back at that time. So let's go ahead and take on this coccyx. What he said was a tailbone. This other piece of evidence that the man who was just showing that the appendix wasn't good evidence but was holding on to this piece of evidence, what about this piece of evidence right here? This is your coccyx right there. It sits right at the end of your sacrum, what people call your tailbone. This is what it looks like from an anatomy textbook. Here's your sacrum right there, right at the end of your spinal cord. There it is. And then right at the end, these little bones, 4 or 5 bones, sometimes fused together. That's what's called your tailbone. They're fused together, but they're not totally fused. In fact, there's even a little joint between there. And sometimes when women get pregnant and their uterus tips, it can actually take the coccyx and tip it up, stretching that joint, leading to some pain during pregnancy. So it is somewhat mobile, but that's what it looks like right there. And if you went into the American Museum of Natural History in New York, you would read this, the end of the tail. Look closely at the base of the human spine, and you'll find a tailbone, 3 to 5 vertebrae fused together. It serves no purpose, but reminds us that humans have descended from ancestral animals with tails. People going through the museum, they see that. It's evidence that we descended because it serves no purpose. Wow, no purpose whatsoever on that. The Lord is obviously saying, that's a lie, that's a lie. I made it for a purpose on there. Well, this is what it would look like. On the left side of the screen is a female body. If you were a good surgeon, you could take all the organs and you could look from the inside out. You would see here, here's this little coccyx right at the end of it. Do you see muscles attached to it? Do you see ligaments attached to it? You sure do. Just to be fair, we'll look at the male side from the outside in. Right here, here's your little the little coccyx, the little bone right there, which is misnamed a tailbone. Do you see muscles attached to it? Of course you do. Those muscles are part of the pelvic floor. They're anchored to it, and they serve to hold vital structures in place. In fact, they're essential for the pelvic floor. It's not a useless bone in the slightest, and it never was a tailbone, never develops into a tail, not even as an embryo does it show any features of a tail. Your body grows into the back of the backbone, and it reaches upon maturity the full length. It's only the imagination of somebody who's looking at the embryo who would ever think that it was a tail. In fact, it serves a very useful function, as you can see which ligaments it holds there. One of my colleagues at ICR, Frank Sherwin, says this in one of his talks. If you think that this coccyx is a useless feature in your body, ICR, our ministry, will pay the surgical costs for you to have it removed. But you will have to pay the costs of the diapers you'll be in the rest of your life. On that, useless feature. Nobody stepped up to the plate for that surgery. Anyway, the coccyx is not the same as a tail, has nothing to do with a tail. Anybody who knows it has nothing to do with a tail, but it's still being taught as evidence for evolution. Clearly, it's still being claimed that it has no function, trying to reinforce the teaching of evolution. It is very important. Okay, let's switch features now and talk about evolutionary psychology. Evolutionary psychology on that. Evolutionary psychology is really important for a lot of people. They're trying to explain human behaviors. So what evolutionary psychology does is this. They imagine that human beings and ape-like creatures shared an ancestry. We shared an evolutionary development. And that not only included our bodies and features, but also included our behaviors. And you can read the headlines and decide for yourself whether these declarations about why we do what we do make any sense. So what these evolutionary psychologists do is they study animals, all different kinds of animals, but the primary animal that they study are chimpanzees because they're our supposed closest human relative. They study chimpanzees and they figure out what the chimps are thinking when they behave the way they do. That's a toughie, but they do it. So they watch the chimps and they watch their behaviors and then they figure out what the chimps are thinking and then they project that onto who? Human beings. And that explains why we do what we do. Because they figured out why the chimps do what they do and therefore what we do usually is tied way, 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 way back to our evolutionary past. Okay, so let's look at some of these pronouncements that they've made. Over on the left-hand side of the page, is the meaning of your life, from Scientific American, is the meaning of your life to make babies? Wow, obviously, it clearly is. I haven't heard anybody say no on any of that. How about this one? Does postpartum depression serve an evolutionary purpose? Postpartum depression. How many of you women want that? Well, women get it. So obviously, there has to be an explanation for that. That explanation is tied to our evolutionary what? Roots. It wouldn't persist in the human population if it didn't serve some evolutionary purpose. Because if it didn't have a purpose, it wouldn't persist because natural selection, in their view, would eliminate it. How about this one? Unsexy guys annoy fertile girlfriends. Is that true, guys? If you say yes, we'll know something about your girlfriend, and more importantly, we'll know something about you on all of that. How about this one? Female animals look drab to avoid sexual harassment, study shows. Wow, there you go. That explains it. Why they look a little drab, they don't want to be sexually harassed by the other animals. There, someone thinks that is kind of funny. I know. That really makes a lot of sense. Oh, there's an evolutionary reason guys like curves. Did you know that, guys?
Your wives are looking at you. You see, she's shaking his arm. Oh, he is an ape. I knew it on that. Oh, poor guy on that. You know, there's an evolutionary reason to that. I can give you another reason. Ask me offline. Anyway, this gal, Sharon Begley, she's a science writer for Newsweek. I'm glad she wrote this. She said, "Men attracted to young, curvaceous babes were fitter because such women were the most fertile. Mating with dumpy, barren hags is not a good way to grow a big family tree." Wow. There's the evolutionary reason, guys, like curves. You know, I mean, you know, dumpy, barren hags. It sounds like one of Donald Trump's tweets, you know? When I see that, Angela Pelosi, dumpy, barren hag. Anyway, you know, it's just like I could just see him tweeting that out on there. Wow. I didn't say that. That's just pure imagination acting up on there. It's just in my mind. Any resemblance is purely coincidental. How about this one? How makeup makes men admire but other women jealous. Females are more negative toward each other. Chimp behavior unraveled. Is that true? Females more negative to each other? Sexy guys get more love from fertile gals. Men's preferences for certain body types has evolutionary roots. Some STIs, sexually transmitted infections, are beneficial and may have boosted evolutionary promiscuity. Oh, man. Lady liaisons, does cheating give females an evolutionary advantage? Wow. Some of you people thinking, wow, I wish they would evolve more. Love, fall in love with cannibalism this Valentine's Day. Whoa. Why do men rape? An evolutionary psychological perspective. You get more serious, we're upping the ante. Why do men rape? Of course, you've been told by the feminists that men rape in order to get power. You know what these guys said? This paper was rejected by the feminists. Not because of the evolutionary psychology, because they said men rape not to get power over women, but because they like it. That doesn't fly very well, doesn't advance anyone's agenda. So we could go on and on and on with all of these studies that have been proven wrong. This man here, a full evolutionist, he believes in evolution as much as any of the major evolutionists, but he wrote a very honest paper, The Darwinian Cage, Evolutionary Psychology as Moral Science, in 2008. He says this, "Evolutionary psychology is empirically unwarranted and conceptually incoherent to such an extent that it is a matter of professional sociological concern why it has come to achieve such a degree of popularity." That's good analysis. How can studying animals ever explain anything that humans are doing in terms of behavior? It's conceptually incoherent. He goes on to explain this, but evolutionists are content to live in that cage due to a compelling, quote, commitment to naturalistic explanations, since no one wishes to keep company with the creationists. The evolutionary psychological program appears irresistible. You know what he's saying is this? Nobody wants to keep company with me because I'll tell you why people behave the way they do, because I can turn to a book which is going to explain the reason why we behave the way we do. But nobody wants to keep company with that. And so as the alternative to that, they're content to live in their evolutionary cage, no matter how incoherent their conclusions are on all of that. So imagination, not necessarily tied to reality or experience at all, but can become very popular in trying to explain things. And then finally, we'll end with this one right here, the eugenics disaster. Eugenics disaster. This is all based on evolution. In fact, we'll go into specific details on what part of evolutionary theory it's based on. So what was eugenics? In fact, what is eugenics? Eugenics was, and still is, the quest to improve humanity's genetic composition. Some of you are ranchers. You want your cattle to have good genetic composition. Eugenicists selectively bred superior people, at least the people they believed were superior people, and eliminated genetic defects by sterilizing or aborting or euthanizing the inferiors, the people that they thought were inferiors. So it's just like a type of breeding, except it's human breeding. And it was very popular a little over 100 years ago, actually still 100 years ago, since we only have to go back to the 1920s during this time, in the United States, in Great Britain, and of course we know what country did it the most? Germany. Wrong. Germany did not do it the most. The country that did it the most was the United States of America. You didn't hear that in class. You weren't taught that around here. Well, it was the United States of America as we imported it from Great Britain. This man, Carl Pearson, he was a famous British mathematician. We even still use some of his equations today in biostatistics. He's giving a speech here to medical doctors, people like me, medical doctors. And this is why he's going to explain why we need eugenics. He says this, "Let me, even at the risk of talking about the familiar, sketch for you the broad outline of Darwin's theory of evolutionary progress. The individual better fitted to its environment lived longer than its fellows, had more offspring, and these inheriting its better fitness raised the type of the race. Nevertheless, medical science has to face the fact that the upward progress of man in the past has been largely controlled by stringent Darwinian selection. What will happen if by increased medical skill and by increased state support and private charity, so medical skill, state support, private charity, we enable the weaklings to survive and to propagate their kind? I say that the general death rate is selective. In many ways, medical science has led to a survival of the unfit." Wow. He gave this speech in 1912. He says, now you, medical doctors, if you're going to take Darwinism as your theory of life, like I take Christianity as my guiding point in life. If you're going to take Darwinism as your theory of life and apply it to human problems, you must not only believe it to be true, that's his emphasis, not mine, but you must set to it and demonstrate it that it actually applies. Do you know what he's saying this? He's saying that throughout the course of human evolution, we arrived at the highest species due to stringent natural selection, which means that the unfit of the human beings died, and that only the fittest, according to his view, whatever the fittest is, went on to reproduce. Now, medical doctors, private charity, and state sponsorship are allowing the weaklings to live and reproduce. That's what he's saying. And what is that doing to humanity? It's tearing us down. So you medical doctors, if you're going to take this as your theory of life, you can't just say that you believe in Darwinism, you must also apply it. What does he mean by apply it, medical doctors? You must let the weakest among us what? Die. That's what he's saying. Not only should you let them die, maybe you should even hasten their death. That's what he's saying. He wanted to say this. That is, I think, he said this a few years later, the ever-present fear which the scientific mind recognizes. Civilized man has largely destroyed crude evolution. Now, he doesn't say crude evolution. He says crude what? Natural selection. You know what? When creationists push back against eugenics and they're talking about evolution, they're not specific enough. It was this concept that Darwin invented about natural selection which was being invoked. In my own mind, and in a growing number of other minds, Civilization will end unless civilization can find a method of doing for itself what natural selection did for man during his ascent, ensuring that he shall breed only from his best. The study of how it is possible forms the subject matter of what we term the science of eugenics. We have to replace the ruthless action of natural selection by the reasoned conduct in civilized man. Wow, there's the mark of civilization. You allow people to what? That are sick, die, and you hasten them along, die. You invoke crude natural selection. And when you do that, you will be a civilized man. This is what became popular. This is what was taught at all the major schools in the United States. They had international conferences on this. They had journals on it. Three major peer-reviewed journals that taught that this was eugenics. And because of this peer-reviewed information, over 33 states in the United States passed eugenics laws. It was the eugenics laws of Indiana and Virginia, which the Nazis copied into their eugenics laws from the United States. It was these eugenics laws, which are based not on evolution. So the next time you hear another creationist say evolution, you say, no, no, you've got it wrong. It was the natural selection, survival of the fittest portion, which was invoked for the eugenics disaster. Can you see nature select? Some of you might even say that. Oh, that animal was selected against. That animal was selected for. No, nature can't select anything. The mere fact that a coyote freezes to death in North Dakota wasn't selected against, selected for. That whole action is nothing but imagination. The toad doesn't select against that snake, and the snake doesn't select against that toad. Nobody's selecting anything. That whole idea is just a terrible concept. What you see there up on the screen, the gal on the left is, her name is Carrie Buck. That's her mom on the right. Her name is Emma. This picture was taken in 1922, so not quite 100 years ago in the United States. Carrie Buck was selected by the state to be sterilized because she was deemed to be mentally unfit. Her mother was also believed to be mentally unfit. And the state which she was living in said that you could forcibly sterilize people if they were mentally unfit. She didn't want to be sterilized, surprise, surprise. And she argued the case, and it went to the United States Supreme Court. What I'm going to read to you is the Supreme Court decision. From the Supreme Court decision, Buck versus Bell, on that 1927. Carrie Buck, quote, is the probable potential parent of socially inadequate offspring, likewise afflicted, that she may be sexually sterilized without detriment to her general health, and that her welfare and that of society will be promoted by her sterilization, and thereupon make the order. The order for what? The order for her to be sterilized. And in fact, the order said that her fallopian tubes will be cut with the intent that she will be sterilized. And they ordered her to be sterilized. And then the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court at that time, Oliver Wendell Holmes, he wrote in the majority opinion, quote, we have seen more than once that the public welfare may call upon the best citizens for their lives. It would be strange if it could not call upon those who already sap the strength of the state for lesser sacrifices, often not felt to be such by those concerned. Of course not. You know, I'll translate. He says, if we can send men off to die for the country, then we can certainly sterilize people, which isn't as bad a deal as being killed. Of course, they don't think that being sterilized is such a minor thing. Often not felt to be such by those concerned, in order to prevent our being swamped with incompetence. It is better for all the world if society can prevent those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their kind. The principle that sustains compulsory vaccination is broad enough to cover cutting the fallopian tubes. Three generations of imbeciles are enough. Wow. And Carrie Buck was forcibly sterilized. Turns out, Carrie Buck was not mentally incompetent at all. Carrie Buck was totally normal. Carrie Buck's mother, Emma, was totally normal. Obviously, Carrie Buck never had any children on her own. But the state forced her to be sterilized because of that. And that continued in the United States. As I mentioned, 33 states passed these laws. And in the United States, over 70,000 Americans were forcibly sterilized during that time in all of these states, all based on Darwinian natural selection. In fact, this is less than 100 years ago. You could go to state fairs and you could take your kids to the eugenics building where they could be examined. In Baltimore, this picture of boys in classrooms being examined to see which ones were the fittest and which ones were unfit. Can you imagine doing something like that today? You could take your kids to the state fair where they could be examined by medical doctors and they could be determined which one was the fittest in the state. And gals, you could go to a medical doctor after he examined your potential husband and he could give you a eugenic certificate that the guy you're about to be married was, you know, grade A prime beef or whatever it would be, whatever the stamp was that they put on you for those kinds of things. All in this Darwinian worldview, not evolution, but Darwin's concept of natural selection, which has brought this on. These gals were the last two sterilized in the United States, forcibly sterilized, and it happened in what year? 1973. It was in the state of Alabama. There was three sisters. The oldest one had an IUD forcibly inserted. The two youngest, ages 14 and 12, were forcibly sterilized. And that was when the last eugenics law was overturned in the United States. Hadn't heard about this? Didn't know about this? All based on Darwinian natural selection. You know, it's interesting. Here's one of those peer-reviewed scientific journals. Eugenics Quarterly, 1968. Conveniently switched without even missing an edition. Changed the name to Social Biology. All based on Darwinian evolution. This man, a thorough evolutionist, Randolph Nessie, he wants to bring natural selection into medical schools, but he does admit this. In the late 19th and early 20th centuries, most applications were, quote, medical Darwinism that focused on the welfare of the species. In connection with eugenics, this led to moral and social disaster. I think that qualifies as a major evolutionary blunder, without a doubt. A major evolutionary blunder. And this whole view of natural selection, which some in this room might even endorse or embrace or promote, survival of the fittest, I mean, that's just the way it is. It isn't the way it is. Death is not the means to good. Death was not God's invention to eradicate the unfit. God is not a eugenicist here who delights in seeing the weaklings amongst us die in order for the benefit of all human beings. Death, as you can see up there, is something unnatural. The Bible says it's a curse. The Bible says it's an enemy. The Bible says it will be eliminated. It is not the means to good. And how can Christianity make a peace with this man's worldview where in even celebration of his 200th anniversary, they put skulls on his birthday cake? Wow. That's because that's what his worldview is. Some of you may be getting old enough there. Your kids might put a skull on your cake. But this is because this is what his worldview entails. So the eugenics natural selection. You notice I didn't call it eugenics evolution. It's eugenics survival of the fittest nonsense. But you need to know, it was belief in natural selection which fuels eugenics. Humans mimic. When humans are trying to do eugenics, they're trying to mimic natural selection. And as I mentioned, it's not God's program. When someone who's sick, who has a disease, dies of it, it's not a gift to the rest of us. It's a tragedy. That's what it is. And this is the book that can explain all of those to you, can help it out. So, major evolutionary blunders, what you need to know. All of them are based on imagination. That's why they happened. That's why they'll continue to happen. Evolutionists see what they want to see, and they teach it as fact on all of these things. And in believing in this is what causes these blunders and will continue to cause the blunders. So, where can you get some additional information? How Natural Selection is Given Credit for Design. That's from our magazine. Absolutely free. I know most of you already get it. We usually have some free samples, but we ran out. Sorry. But I do have an example in the back of the room. You can sign up for this. This is absolutely free. We have donors who give to our ministry who want you to get this information. I wrote a whole series about eugenics and selection on this with a lot more data than I even covered. You should get this magazine if you don't already. Parents, you should get it for your kids' sake, grandparents for your grandkids' sake. It's a very, very useful resource, and as I say, we have donors who want you to have that for free. Acts and Facts talks about design, evolutionist, a whole series of articles on the latest current events as well. There's a DVD series in the back, Made in His Image, explains four major biological features and why they point to not just design, but they import to incredible engineering by the Lord Jesus Christ. This is useful to lead people to worship, Human Body Guide. And then our best and latest book is this upgraded one-of-a-kind that's right out here. It's like one good book for everything, Creation Basics and Beyond. One book covers a whole bunch of topics, including these things on selection and other areas. So thank you very much for that. Pastor, before we turn it over, I want to make you really look good. I'll open up. We'll take 10 minutes of questions. 10 minutes of questions. And I know everybody always wants questions, so we'll do it. Can't go on forever. But if you have a question, shoot it at me. We'll cover them for 10 men, and then we'll call it quits. Sound good? Anybody have a question? Yes, sir.
People that are working for them, you might say, because there are some very large donors. The donor wants a certain outcome with their experimentations or their what they find in a bone or whatever, you know. So don't you think that there would be fewer people in that field, so to speak, if the checks stop coming?
Amen. Yeah, of course there would be. Yeah, so you raise a, not only is your question good, but you have a really good observation. Evolutionary thinking is actually big business. Big business. It's just like a lot of things. You know, you talk about abortion, that's big business. And there's a lot of money involved with it. And it's big business for the colleges. They get a lot of grants. It's big business for the leading researchers there. They sell a lot of books. They go on the speaking tour. They get honorariums. And it's big business for publishing companies and other things. It's big business for the peer-reviewed scientific journals. A lot of articles would never get published if they didn't have some evolutionary spin to them. And what's really a scam for these journals is most of the research is paid for by taxpayers in one grant or another, and then it's used this other way. So you're right. This can be big business for them, and the money really is driving the show. And in fact, some of the things that are promoted are only because they are so sensational and will grab headlines in order to do it. Don't you think National Geographic jumped on Archaeoraptor right away because of that? Yes. Far in the back. Him first. Yes, sir. Yeah, I would say, no, you're not going to flip the card back on me on imagination, because
What I'm actually pushing for is for an engineering-based approach to biology. What I'm actually pushing for is to get the magic and the imagination out of biology so that when I look at biological systems and I see an outcome, I want engineering causality to dominate, which means this. When I see a pathway or I see something happening, I want everything that is observed to be included and nothing that isn't observed to be included, including any magical steps where nature supposedly selects for, selects against, or anything along those lines. I want to bring it into the totally objective field of engineering to where we start viewing biology not as something separate from engineering, but the practice of biology is a subset of engineering. That's how I think we can save biology from the magic which is permeating it in every way. So, and then also, I would say I gave you a history, and I've got the whole book, of one imagination-based blunder after another. I could turn to the recurrent laryngeal nerve or any other things where they've just been proven wrong again and again and again. And you can't find a history of creationists where we've been found wrong over and over again. Amen. Thank you. Last question. Yes, sir.
Yeah, so there's a guy I listen to. He's an astrophysicist, Brian Cox. I don't know if you've heard of him at all or not, but he has an interesting perspective of only sticking to objective science, clearly coming from a poor objective science of the assumption of the Big Bang, so obviously hypocritical stance. My question is, are you seeing people that are your mirror on the other side of the coin coming back to the middle saying, sure, let's set aside our religious affiliation differences, whatever it might be, and let's actually just trace that scientific method back to the beginning? Or are they saying, no, you've got God and I've got evolution?
If you wonder what I'm seeing, I'm actually seeing kind of a hybrid response to what you're just talking about. I have not seen anybody on the naturalistic side saying we're going to give up our worldview of naturalism with its basic assumptions. And ultimately, the basic assumption is that nature creates itself. And nature creates itself through the Big Bang. Nature creates itself through the origin of life. Nature creates the diversity of life. And so I am not seeing any retreat from that basic premise of naturalism whatsoever. On the other hand, I am seeing a retreat from traditional basic Darwinian views because they are not standing up to observations, and far more data is coming in, which is totally contrary to the basic Darwinian views, which are basic random genetic mutations, which are the raw fuel for the genetic varieties within a population, being weeded out by their magical selector, natural selection. I see scientists recognizing the mysticism of natural selection. I see lots of scientists recognizing that basic undirected genetic mutations is not the way. I see a lot of scientists recognizing that there is actual control and regulated mechanisms leading to genetic changes, which we'll talk about tomorrow night. We're going to talk about a whole mechanism of natural genetic engineering, which organisms sense changes in the environment, and it leads to very purposeful and very almost predictable adaptations. So I see a pushback against stringent Darwinism because it's just not making sense and the evidence isn't coming in to back it up. But giving up on naturalism? I mean, if nature didn't create itself, then the alternative is nature was created. That's the part that they won't go to, which is a perfect segue to turn it over to Pastor Hilbert. Thank you very much.